Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2006, and today's session is entitled Why Do Good People Do Bad Things? Presented by Lowell Satry, number SAL 2006-05. Let's listen in.
Yeah, spin the desk, turn on the mic, whatever it is, whoever's doing, get to the little room, wherever they're doing this. I'm Lowell Satry. I'm a retired professor of history from Youngstown State University in Youngstown, Ohio. I'm going to plug my book again. I've been doing that every once in a while. It is available in the bookstore. Chocolate on Trial, Slavery, Politics, and the Ethics of Business. It deals with a libel trial involving the Cadbury Chocolate Company. All of you have eaten Cadbury chocolate. It is based in Birmingham, England. And the trial revolves around their purchase of cocoa beans in the early 20th century that were created by slave labor. And then there are a lot of ethical questions that are also raised in that book. But the session today I'm doing is, why do good people do bad things? And here we're dealing not only with the high and the mighty, but I think it's important to keep in mind that this question ultimately involves all of us and all people. All of us, one time or another, do bad things. And when we do it, we ask ourselves, I'm sure, in most cases, why did I do that? How could I actually do that? And yet we do it probably with some fair regularity. And it is a most basic question, I think, which we, again, often ask. And the answers that we give vary to why do good people do bad things. The answers we give to ourselves will vary to a great extent according to our background. I'm a historian. And I think when I approach this question, I probably almost always address it from a historical sense. If some of you are specifically involved in religion, you probably ask yourself often the religious basis to it. For some of you, it may indeed come around to the concept of original sin. And indeed that we are all evil. We are all bad. None of us is capable of doing good. So it is only logical, if you look at it that way, that indeed we're going to do bad things. You might look at it as a psychologist or a psychiatrist, trying to delve into the deepest irrational part, especially of a human mind. I suspect nobody has been put on the couch more posthumously than Adolf Hitler. There's an industry, a psychohistory industry, that basically developed around him to try to figure out why that person did what he did. What I'm going to do today is to give you some basic comments, ideas on this question. But ultimately, it'll take me 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes, after I'm done, I'm going to open it up for discussion, and I want to find out what you think about why people do bad things. And that's going to be the most important part, certainly, of today's session, is your comment. My idea for this topic, I guess, originated from my own book. There's one person in this book, William Cadbury. He plays the main role. And William Cadbury is a very good person. He is a pious, devout Quaker. And I don't know that I would ever call him a bad man, but certainly it's fair to say he made some really bad decisions. He made some bad judgments. And indeed, it is a type of judgments or decisions that a person will, I suppose you could say, regularly make, including this person who was indeed a very, very pious Quaker. And he came from a large pious Quaker family. I've met a member of the family today. They are still 100 years later, pious and Quakers.
I have to interrupt this session for a second.
Go ahead. That's fine.
The vault is kaput. The boat, the Lady of the Lake, and it hasn't left Fields Point yet. Okay. Oh. And that affects our teaching staff person here.
You're stuck with us.
I think it's been suggested you should probably get on this bus. It left an hour ago. No. It is going to leave in about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Dorothy went to find her.
Oh, okay.
So we're kind of covering it for yourself.
Okay.
Because he has to be in Nevada next.
Yeah, I'm going to be in Nevada Monday for a wedding.
Will he eventually come? Because we're scheduled to go too.
To the set later? On the 145?
Yeah.
My understanding is that if they don't get it going, they're going to run two runs with the Lady of the Lake, the fast boat.
Express.
It'll run twice. Yeah, the Express.
Okay.
Do you need help,
Paul? No, I think Ellen will grab it.
Your stuff is down here. And
I'm assuming she will.
And I see Mark here. I don't want to dump on you, but can you carry on this? It's a conversation.
But I will do.
I
have only 10 or 15 minutes of introductory comments to make.
Okay.
I was literally going to open it to the group for their time.
That's what Dorothy said, and I just wanted to tell you.
Well, let's do that. Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Yep. So let me get on. Maybe these comments will be only 10 minutes now. I will cut them. So it partly arose out of William Cadbury, but it also actually partly arose living in Youngstown, Ohio. About 8 years ago, there was a lead article in New Republic magazine. That lead article had said, the most corrupt city in the United States. Youngstown, Ohio. So this question I face, anybody living in Youngstown, or well, unfortunately in Ohio, faces this question probably more than most of you do. A neighbor of mine, very bright person, the best of the three city judges we had, ended up essentially accepting bribes, and he ended up serving 5 years in prison, and this is common. Two of our three city judges at one time served time in federal prison. Two of our three county commissioners served time in prison. Our city engineer was in prison. Three of five sheriffs in a row ended up in prison.
Wow.
It's incredible. It's just absolutely amazing. The treasurer of the city, Youngstown City Schools, ended up taking $80,000 from the city, and she served time. No, he served time in prison. I never knew him. The most astonishing thing recently in Ohio deals with our governor, Robert Taft. Robert Taft, who was he was referred to as Mr. Clean and Mr. Ethicist. And yet he was found out he had accepted, essentially it amounted to bribes or gifts, of going on 60 different golf outings and never reporting them, as is required under Ohio law. He had never reported it. And he ended up, he pleaded guilty, and he was fined $3,000, given a slap on his hand that amounted to. But here was the first governor in Ohio history who violated the law and was found guilty and was charged. I mean, charged and was found guilty. And this is a person who, a month before this emerged, had been, and he goes around the state lecturing and telling people how they have to be clean, had specifically used the example. Yes, Paul.
Yeah. I'm sorry I have to interrupt again.
No.
We just found out that if you are planning to go out today and don't get on this bus, you might not get to Chelan until about 8 o'clock tonight. So if there's anybody else, I mean, you know you have to go, but this bus is leaving at 11:15.
So okay, I will be there.
You have to get your stuff.
Okay.
Yep. Anybody else in that category?
Lowell, do you need me to go get your stuff?
No, I think Dorothy probably went to find Ellen, and let's trust that.
You want to
trust
me? Let me just do a few more things. A few more things, and I will run to you. One of the most important people, and certainly some of you may know this, one of the most important people in the 20th century raising this question was Reinhold Niebuhr. He wrote a book in about 1930 called Moral Man and Immoral Society. And when I was getting ready for this topic, I read most of his book. It's not an easy read. It's a tough book. And it was written in 1930, and he was to a great extent responding to the rise of fascism and Nazism. So that's the area he's dealing with. But almost all of the articles that I have read over the last month or so, they almost every single one acknowledged Reinhold Niebuhr as raising this question. It is the most basic thing. And what he is referring to more than anything, one of the interesting things he comments on is that individuals who are good people, who do good things, once they could become a part of a group, of a larger association, can easily end up doing bad things. And it can be referred to, the term he uses is collective egoism, one of the terms that is used. And he goes on and gives a number of examples, I mean, on this. But and there are a number of others. I'm going to just shift to a couple others. But behind all of this, indeed, is Reinhold Niebuhr. I want to mention a little bit about another person by the name of Adam Hochschild, who has written a great number of books recently. And in his book, The Unquiet Ghost, and it deals with, he lived in Russia for about 1 year, 1991-92, just after the fall of the old Soviet Empire. And he visited the country and talked to them about Stalin and what Stalin meant to him and the gulags and all that terrible stuff in Russia that had gone on. And he raises the question, can good people do bad things? And he says, yes. As is shown in the studies of Nazis, of Americans in Vietnam, of South African police, if the enemy, Jews, blacks, Vietnamese, or enemies of the people, is sufficiently dehumanized by the relentless din of propaganda, if the murder or torture is sanctioned by peer pressure, by heads of state, by commands from those in authority, it is a rare person who will resist. Perhaps some people are born saints and some devils. But most of us are somewhere in between, influenced in the end by what the people around us are doing. And that's powerful stuff that he's writing about. One other thing, and then I guess I will run. I mean, and in some ways, I wouldn't mind having you stay overnight here again. It would make it even more difficult to get to Nevada on time. This is a little statement from Forest Church. Forest Church is a Unitarian Universalist minister. I am Unitarian Universalist. He wrote an article called Choose Your Enemies Carefully. It was published in the July-August 2004 edition of the UU World. And he's talking here about Abu Ghraib, the prison where the Americans brutalized some of the Iraqis. And he says, quoting here, actually the president, what happened in Abu Ghraib does not represent America, our president said. And he is right. Church goes on to say, and he is right. It represents human nature. It's not only that good people sometimes do bad things, or that in every barrel there are a few bad apples, but that the veneer of civilized behavior is thin, fragile, and of relatively recent application. There has never been a war in which we humans have not dehumanized our enemies, leading the victors to treat the vanquished like animals. And barring strict internal controls and external oversights, prisons are almost by definition inhumane. Under stress, and here he's reflecting Niebuhr, especially in crowds or small packs, human behavior easily becomes wanton and brutal, bestial, we say. The last thing I'll mention, and then I'm going to skedaddle while I'll get back to you while I'm saying it. The other thing I think, another thing that particularly has a huge impact on human behavior over the last two centuries is the development of the nation and the concept of nationalism. There is nothing that has become more powerful in shaping life and shaping it absolutely as the concept or the idea of the nation. The nation has, over the last 2 centuries, essentially replaced the family and religion as the most important aspect of life. And it's a new concept. Nationalism and the loyalty and honor to the nation is only from the 19th and 20th century. It's very new. If you'd have asked somebody living in Boston, Massachusetts in 1805 what he was or what she was, they would have never said they were an American. They would have said, I'm a New Englander. Only in the course of the 19th century that developed. And the nation is so powerful. And I'll say one last thing, and then I'm exiting. The greatest statement indicating the power of the nation is the bumper sticker you will occasionally see. My nation, right or wrong. It is the ultimate surrender. You have given up all rights to control your life. You have given up all rights to make an ethical decision. You have given up all rights of judgment. Goodbye.
I studied American religious nationalism. Master's degree in American religious history, and the first class I took that totally turned me on to exactly what he's just been talking about was American religious nationalism. And it was like, whoa, this is my subject. So I don't want to take over from what he was lecturing, but I would like to encourage discussion along that idea. And I know Roy, you know, my Uncle Roy here, Lowell's brother.
Believe it or not, I'm Lowell's brother.
This is Lowell's brother, and he's known Lowell even longer than I have. And dialogue with him forever. So I'm going to let you you be the monitor because you're more used to it. But
well, let's...
Both? Okay, fine.
Well, let's open it up.
Yeah, let's open it up to what he just said.
Yeah.
You know, my nation, right or wrong. I mean, I am truly a victim, if I choose to be. If I choose to be a victim, I am a victim of the Vietnam era where I toyed with going to Canada. Why? Why? I'm a woman. I wasn't being faced with the draft. Why is this something I've wondered for the last 40-some years? Should I have gone? Well, I didn't go. I'm here. And it has been a huge factor in my life. Huge. I don't know if my parents yet know to this day, maybe you don't, that I had a boyfriend the week after the Kent State killings who said, if I run, will you go with me? Well, he didn't run. I didn't marry him. But it's a huge question in my life. Should I have gone to Canada and ranted and raved against America?
So the power of nation.
It's real.
Yeah, it's real.
Yeah. There's just starting to be more feminist scholarship on the fact that women are as affected by this as men, even if we don't get drafted.
Well, I'm going to throw this in just facetiously, but...
Yeah.
Being a Texan, I don't have that problem because when we come from Texas, we're Texans first.
Right, and I lived there, and I tried to tell people I'm an American in Texas.
I'm being silly.
No, it's real. It's real. I better sit down.
Jared Diamond in what's it? Guns, Germs, Steel.
Okay.
Pictures the development of human cultures as kind of carrying us along in a game where the more powerful clusterings of humans always overtake those less powerful. And so the nation state simply happens to be more powerful than the other clusterings that went before. And we've been caught up in something that is bigger than we are.
Oh, I didn't mean to stop anything. I would ask a historical question. What does this mean for us as Christians in 21st century America? Mark, would you put a different spin on the historical question? Or could, does that sound like a good historical question?
Yeah. Well, when it comes to American, and just to say that American civil religion, there's just such a great mix of politics and American history that mixes in with our religious expressions, religious convictions, that we really have to do our best to sort that out and move through it. I think essentially to hold the course of our own understanding and expression of biblical religion and how we express that, teach that, move with it, and how that informs our civic and political life and relationships.
I think I'd to add another bumper sticker, which you see much more often than this one these days. I mean, that was big in the late 60s, early 70s. And it's one I think we ought to think about. It's God Bless America.
Oh, yeah.
Which actually I'm not opposed to God Blessing America. I hope God will bless America. But, you know, in Boston at least, after 9/11, not only did we begin with the Star Spangled Banner, which is typical of every ball game in the U.S., but after the midway through the seventh inning, not only did we get to sing Taking Up the Ball Game, which is lore that goes back 100 years, but God Bless America, everybody's really required. And we don't sing the Star Spangled Banner in Boston, but God Bless America, people sing. And I think there it was evoked partly from fear that somehow we were being attacked. This is certainly the way the administration posed the issue. But I think the bumper sticker ought to cause us to reflect about who we do pray for and how we do invoke God and God's blessings.
And does it mean that we don't want God to bless everyone else?
Yeah.
That's, to me, the bad theology that I see coming from God Bless America. It's good theology if we're really asking God to bless us. It's bad theology if it means, well, we don't want God to bless anybody else. I mean, it can be.
I think it's a place to begin a very real conversation in our congregation, in my congregation, which is about half folks, fairly high-level folks in the defense industry in the 495 corridor of Boston. And they're thinking people. They're not uncritical of these things. They're engaged in the discussion.
Right.
Yeah. It's not a liberal conservative issue.
No, and it's certainly not smart or ignorant.
No, so I think that these provide occasions for us not simply to caricature positions, but to begin a conversation.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed, I mean, is this little bumper sticker everywhere? This little, what is it, a yellow flag thing, like support our troops? I see it
a lot in
Washington State.
Yeah.
And even that one, you know, is loaded.
Well, I support our troops.
Well, sure.
I wish they'd all be able to come home.
Right.
And
but, I mean, it's loaded in that you can argue it from radically different. You know, what does support our troops mean?
Sure.
Anybody else want to
or
Lowell's original question?
I was just going to say, you can support the military personnel, but you may not support the war effort. You know, that's, you know, you don't support why we're in Iraq and we're looking at going into Iran and see we're going to, you know, bomb everybody. You know, I mean, you can be really against that, but you support the people that put their lives on the line to do something. But they're misinformed about why they're there. You know, why are we there? You know, what are we fighting for anyway? For oil? You know, I mean, there's no, you know, they haven't gone after Bin Laden if he's the one responsible. for, you know, for 9/11. And he says, our president says, well, I don't care about him. I don't worry about bin Laden, but that's who we were supposed to get, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, you could support the troops, but you really support the war effort. And that's the loaded question there, because I think a lot of people that put those ribbons on their cars just blanketly, you know, that nation, my nation above
right.
all else, you know,
right.
just support whatever, and I just will do whatever I'm told, you know.
Right.
There's no thinking involved. It's just like I'm just going to be a Kool-Aid drinker, you know. I
yeah.
just do whatever I'm told instead of really questioning that, saying, well, what's really going on here, and, you know,
yeah.
and I don't approve of that, or I don't feel comfortable with that, or I don't, you know, feel disgusted by what's happening to people. That why shouldn't God bless the Iraqis?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we pray to bless those
right.
innocent people?
I was a military wife for 20+ years.
Mm.
It's very hard to even have conversations like we're having among military people. It's just too scary.
You know, coming back to where Lowell began,
mm-hmm.
and with Niebuhr's Moral Man and Moral Society, Niebuhr
yeah.
wrote that in a period when, in point of fact,
yeah.
the real question was, could we be pacifists?
Yeah.
Could we simply say,
right.
we're not going to get engaged
right.
in this European war? It's
right.
And the forces in the churches were actually very strongly
right.
pacifist.
Right.
They remembered World War I.
Right.
This was not distant history.
And it was,
people had lost brothers and fathers and uncles
right.
and
right.
in a horrific struggle
mm-hmm.
in Europe. And the pressure against getting involved again,
isolationism
was very, very strong. So part of what Niebuhr was
right.
saying is, in an immoral society, can we live without armies? And his answer was no. We can't live without armies.
Right.
Otherwise,
right.
evil in the hands of an immoral society must be somehow countered.
Sure.
So it's
yeah.
it gets very complicated.
It gets dicey. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's actually as alive today involving
mm-hmm.
Iraq and other places mm-hmm. in the world. Although we might all, I don't know, maybe we're not all in agreement here that this was a terrible thing. But there is
there's
lot of ambivalence.
There's definitely two sides to it.
Yeah,
this place,
many sides
this
to it.
Place. Holden would attract those who would say it's an immoral war. But the ones who would say that today we are fighting an immoral war probably don't come, or who support the war aren't going to come to Holden Village. There's people in my church in Washington who won't come to Holden Village anymore because it's too
yeah.
conservative.
Well, I can't imagine the Christian community broadly without a strong pacifist voice. But I also can't imagine that if all Christians were pacifists, we know what to really do.
Mark, now, would you state that again? Because I have to know if you really mean what I thought I heard you say.
I do. That is, in a world that is immoral, that is governed, as Niebuhr says, by
yeah.
people who are not going to wake up in the morning and say, how can we treat everybody well?
No,
I
want to hear the statement you said, you can't imagine a church
I can't imagine a church
strong,
without a strong pacifist voice. But
now,
I
by church, do you mean a congregation?
No.
The
Christian community. But I also can't imagine that somehow Christianity would be well served if all of us were vigorous pacifists.
But, I mean, you know, obviously, being who you are, that there are congregations and churches who do not have a pacifist voice.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And there are denominations that
right.
are really shaped
right.
by Quakers.
So when you say you can't imagine, you mean you would wish they didn't exist?
Which?
That there were not denominations, Christian denominations in America?
No, he's saying
no.
church at large.
The church at large.
I can't imagine.
The whole Christian.
We couldn't survive well as Christians without a very strong pacifist voice.
Okay.
I don't know that we'd know what to do if all of us,
we're
all the Christians
were militarist.
And all those others just said, okay,
yeah.
great.
It
we've
wouldn't
got
work.
Carte blanche. Let's
it wouldn't
go.
Work.
And that's Niebuhr's point, that it's more complicated than just to say, let's all try to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, if we all try to
right.
do the right thing, then everybody will be fine.
There's Bruce. Someone at the door here that I don't know if she needs one of us or something.
Bruce,
to get back to the personal level a little bit, I'd like to try to understand a little bit of the personal psychology or understanding about Lowell's initial comment about how we might as individuals have a very strong feeling about our personal position on this, but as we get involved in a group that we identify with and they help us dehumanize our enemy and all of a sudden we change, what happens in ourselves, psychologically or otherwise, that allows us to make that shift from my personal ethics to being willing to do something that, you know, I would have previously thought to be unconscionable.
Yeah.
I think that little statement on the bus, what is it, the trip up is... free. The ride down is costly.
Yeah.
And I think I find every time when I'm at Halden, then I'm with this concept. Then I go down, and maybe for a week or so, I might try to practice some of it. And before long, I really would have to work extra hard to do what I can sit here and hold and feel comfortable doing. For example, just flushing the toilets, leaving it yellow to turn mellow or whatever it is. I have a friend who was in Halden earlier this summer, and she shared with me, we visited her not too long ago in their home, and she said, I'm sorry to say, but we are flushing the toilets now. She said for about a week they tried it, but that was about as long as they could stand it. I mean, that's a very simple answer.
Actually, we started doing that before we ever came here. This is our first time we ever come here. And we heard about that they did that, and we started doing that and are still doing it. But I think Mark answered that with the first thing you said about, I think it's primarily fear-based. And I think the desire to conflate nation and God is the more threatened we are in the world, you know, as the world becomes more tumultuous, as we do or do not approach Armageddon, the fear drives us into a choice between what looks to be the right answer and siding with our nation, you know, which is a pretty evil thing to have to choose. But
so you're suggesting that fear is a strong contributor to this change in my personal ethics, as I see that played out in the community.
I don't see. I mean, what else is there, really? I mean, we can invent. I mean, there are a lot of there's a lot of rationalization around our fears, but it seems to me that's the thing that drives men to do what they don't believe in. You know, they just the government's been and add to that, of course, our the good desire for community, which is the church. It's a constant. We're always driving towards community, and on the other hand, if it's people with a bad idea or bad people, if we can generalize that far, with gathering in community, then we get a mob.
I'd add to that vengeance. Alongside fear, I think that, you know, we will hunt you down, we will take you out, whatever the language of the president was in the State of the Union address. In 2004, that this sense that somehow we will deal with you with the same power that you've dealt with us. And I thought Jonathan did so beautifully with that last night. Where will vengeance get us if we follow the path of vengeance?
So we could end this discussion. What drives us? Does fear drive us?
I think there's a great deal about fairness in the law.
I think the old statement that the religion and family has been replaced by the state, I think that's somewhat oversimplified, because to some degree the nation state does replace religion and family to the extent that it becomes the only haven in a fearful world, the only protection, you know, as long as our government is in control of the major weaponry, eventually family and religion, you know, in that final moment when you have the choice of kill or be killed, or I don't know.
Yeah, well, you raised a good point. I mean, what does drive us? Is it fear? As Christians, we would like to think hope and love drive us. And yet, the question still exists. Even we as Christians are good people who do bad things.
I mean, we can say, oh, it's sin.
But that's just, that's sort of a theological veneer.
Yeah.
I find that approaching it from the kind of questions raised by evolutionary biology to be really helpful, because basically we are organisms that seek to survive, not only for ourselves, but also for those who share our genes. And those drivers will overcome what we think, you know, our consciousness very easily, you know, unless we learn to live more consciously. And so the fear is, you know, that we will not survive, or that our genes will not survive. And we
unconscious fear.
Exactly. It's not up there where we can see it, because then we could ask questions about it. But as long as it's hidden, it can be the driver.
Yeah, I think Barbara touched on that in one of her things, or people countered her with it, you know, that does a lack of knowledge of scientific biology in early Christian writings mean that they, I mean, my question would be, didn't they still know that people want to survive? Do you have to know biology to figure that out? I don't think so.
It gives a way of accounting for it, though.
Right.
That's
not religious. I mean, you
right.
can have a religion of science where you start to worship the scientific answers, and that's just as much of a good and bad.
It seems so that the notion of survival, I might be willing in an extreme case of am I going to survive to lay down my ethics and morals, and I'll kill the other guy so that I can survive.
Or you
but
might kill the other
on,
guy so your child can survive.
But that happens on a personal level as well as it might happen on a societal or group level. So I'm still trying to get at what changes between that from the individual to the group that will allow me to
mm-hmm.
do that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because the group is mm-hmm. giving me this propaganda of fear? I mean, I'm struck by, you probably all remember Michael Moore's movie about the whole thing on fear and the whole culture of fear and how that has caused the increase in the amount of weaponry that we all carry around us as citizens here in the U.S. compared to countries like Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what is it about that shift from the group, from the individual to the group, that causes that?
Yeah, from me to we.
Psychological.
Well,
I've heard of groupthink, and then, you know, in the corporate world, they talk about groupthink and how you come up with stuff that's just way out there because of what this group has felt they can do as an empowered entity.
Well, let me try to hitchhike on that a little bit. I am never an individual Christian. I mean, I am a Christian person, but I function much better within a congregation in Rochester, Minnesota. And that's where I get my meat and potatoes. Huh? That's where I sing with that congregation, and we pray together, and we listen to scriptures, and we hear the sermon from our pastor. And we visit over coffee, and that's where I get my meat and potatoes. Individually, sure, I make decisions that I believe that are appropriate for me, and I count myself on the good side of life, fully and totally aware that I am simultaneously justified and sinful, and that I can move to the sinful end of the spectrum in a moment's time. But one of the things that we all noticed across the country, that the Sunday or two or three or four after 9/11, that we immediately jumped to patriotic hymns in the congregations. And that we did jump on the American Civil Religion bandwagon right away. And
or if we didn't, we caught flat.
Or we caught flat
right.
over it, yeah. And congregations, you know, who didn't do that, people wondered, well, why in the world aren't you singing God Bless America at a time like this? So that kind of shift from individual to a congregation to all across the country with that was just clearly a movement. Boy, that was just an absolute movement, and we dropped off from the personal confession and forgiveness, and from congregational mission attention. We jumped immediately to a defensive posture. And we have to defend, we certainly have to defend what is going on here. And one more thing, that it doesn't do any good to spend much time on a what if, but I do that occasionally. But what if after 9/11 we said to ourselves, we are going to rally the defense of our nation, but we are not going to strike back. I think that, you know, what you were saying, that Mark, that it was not a time to be all pacifists. We certainly had to defend ourselves from one more attack. But what if we would have done that, and if we would not have been the aggressor? And we could have spent millions of dollars in defense of our country and tracking down the aggressor before the aggressor came again. But just ponder what that position would have or could have resulted in, instead of just hundreds and thousands of people, civilians, dying where we are at war now, and 2,500 toward 3,000 deaths, and also thousands of injuries.
Roy, if you'd have been president, we'd have been better off. The defense industry is a little bit too invested in reacting to things, for one thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
To use Barbara's thing, power down, it's hard work for the military. It's really hard work for the military to power down. I'm using Barbara Rossing's hope that we can power down.
Yeah.
That would be hate words within the military culture.
In some way, maybe that very hard reality is kind of, that's what we're up against. I still have to power down. I mean, we can't go out and get, you know, Bechtel or, you know, the United States military industrial complex to power down, or the Marine Corps or some other force, and no one ever could. There's always giving to Caesar what is Caesar's, and all these other forces that are always bigger than the individual. And so for me, coming into Holden this week or the last 24 hours, I'd have to say that I'm compelled by these discussions to realize that there's something for me to do that I do in effect now, like here in front of you, or maybe, you know, on my private hike, and realize that bears do shit in the woods, or do realize that mama bears have little cubs, or realize that good people do bad things, and that we have to flush toilets and stuff like that, and there's a systemic reflection point that makes me realize, what about my war? So I can't really go out and, you know, picket in front of Walmart. I might, but I'm compelled more to think about what is it that disturbs me in the presence of myself. And then, as you were saying, and I think we all would agree, that because we believe in being peacemakers, we find either the courage or the hope to do that by being in community with other people, because it's hard when you're alone to really believe that it's possible. Because sometimes, in the worst case, when you're alone, sometimes you can take your own life because you think it's impossible. So sometimes in the presence of another, like a community or an attachment relationship, you realize, wow, I don't know where the end of the Armageddon is or the apocalyptic big wave or something, but in here or in me, I think I can gather a little bit of courage and a little bit of hope, kind of like back to, Reinhold, I guess he's the guy who was attributed to the prayer about granting the serenity of the things I cannot change. I can't really change the military or the war in Iraq. I probably tried in my own little way. Meanwhile, my nephew is a lieutenant and has a platoon in Ramadi.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to write him letters and say, come home right now.
Yeah.
So it's more about changing something inside of myself.
Sure.
And accept that I have that ability to know the difference. So that's kind of my thinking.
Well, and I follow my motive for my question about what causes that shift from the me to the us is, if I can understand what that is, then maybe as I live in community, I can find ways to uphold those standards, those ethics, those beliefs. In spite of my desire to survive, I can understand, okay, I got to survive, but I need you. I need you, and I need my enemy ultimately as part of this world community in order for us all to survive. So how do I overcome that front global impulse and do something and become part of a community that thinks that way and retains and holds on to those principles and beliefs and doesn't shift to that new thing that will take me down that horrible path?
I would turn it around. How have you so far? How have you found ways? Obviously, if you're asking the question, you've wrestled with it hugely. How have you found ways to do that yourself?
It's hard to articulate, I think, for me, but trying to find, I guess, one small step for me is, I know I've got the evil potential within me, and I see it, I feel it, I hear it, I'm tempted by it. But I try to find some way to make a break between that and what I actually do.
Can you give even one example? With your wife, with your children, with anybody?
Yeah, I see someone, I don't know, I can't give you a very specific example of something that I could have done in this kind of situation, but maybe a possible example would be to see an injustice done to someone.
Mm-hmm.
My temptation would, you see a murder or a rape or a robbery or something, and you want to attack that other guy. And so what is it about that that's going to make me say, no, I'm not just going to attack, can I take that defensive posture, the what if
mm-hmm.
scenario that you've described, rather than an offensive posture?
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to go pulverize the guy
mm-hmm.
for what he's done,
mm-hmm.
and that's my desire.
Mm-hmm.
How can I make the break from that
mm-hmm.
And say, no, how can I be merciful to this?
Break from
person?
Retaliation or vengeance.
Yes, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah.
But the impulse that started the Left Behind series was self-righteous indignation. And how do we battle that impulse? I think, was his name Ferrix, the Israel-Palestine?
Jonathan.
Something that he continually says that's I think is so important is things about, and is this that line biblical there, but by the grace of God go I? Anyway, you can continually, that's the thing we need to learn over and over.
That would be a proverb,
is that all of us are capable of all manner of sin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he talks about, if you understood the Palestinian situation a little better, basically, if you if your family, your last three generations of ancestors had been treated unfairly, not invited to the talks, this and that, you know, had your country divided up by Britain and handed over to, piece of it handed over to Israel, you know, maybe you'd have a, after about three generations, maybe you'd have a more suicidal mentality than you might imagine. And I think that seems to me to be the essence of peacemaking, is to understand that we're all capable of just about anything.
Trying to go back to the question, where do you find the resources for not going the path of least resistance? In one of the lectures earlier, Mark focused on the phrase "in Christ," and to express it as entering into the mystery of Christ, so that our identity becomes Christ, who did not retaliate, who refuses the path of violence. It's what one of the concepts that I find helpful for characterizing the most easy relationship to the nation state is idolatry. It is elevating the nation state to the status of, you know, the ultimate, of what has first say in everything. Mm-hmm. As we are in Christ, we refuse every form of idolatry that says either, you know, that there's something so special and unique about America that anything is permissible to defend America, which is really only a large expression of what we most easily and naturally do with our own lives. Mm-hmm. There, you know, believing that there's something so special and unique about our own life that if push comes to shove, anything is permissible to defend our own lives. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely what Jesus refuses.
Or our own children.
Well, yeah, which is an extension of our own lives.
Right.
That's
but
or even beyond our own children, our own group. Mm-hmm. It's survival isn't necessarily individual survival, but survival of that, you know, the gene pool to which we belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an important distinction.
Right. I mean, so
that,
like,
you start thinking about your children, you're more apt to
do almost.
You may be more apt to act irrationally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I think so.
That we could say that also, that it, not just when it comes down to the survival of self. Survival of child may be more crazy.
We were talking earlier about these various bumper stickers, and I know it's a cliche, but it's a fairly profound one to think, what would Jesus do? I think there's a lot of good thought that goes behind that as well. You know, maybe it can be interpreted a lot of different ways, but there's a sense in which what you're saying really gets back to that sense.
Well, I think Jesus would do what Lloyd did.
Yeah, he would suffer his life rather than take on his life. Mm-hmm.
And then I have to throw this out because it just occurs to me from that. I've done a bunch of men's study stuff, and I wonder, do you ever have the suspicion that Jesus was just a little short on testosterone?
No. Are you kidding?
I'm making that as a joke. I think there's a kind of an undercurrent of suspicion in some segments of society. And I think it relates to the sort of my dad's generation. Mom was a good Catholic and got all the kids to church every week and all their different things. And, you know, Dad showed up for Christmas and Easter or whatever, but I think there's kind of some of the John Wayne mentality that pervades the...
I mean, because Jesus wasn't wasn't an idiot, right? I mean, he wasn't just...
He wasn't quite as manly as he
could. Well, that's a huge, in American religious history, that's a huge, you know, the manly man Jesus, the masculine Jesus. It started about the beginning of the 20th century to be a huge cultural impulse in American Christianity.
Well, but yeah. Then you look at religious art, and I worked for a Catholic sister for a few years who detested conventional Catholic art. She referred to the you know, pictures of the Lady Jesus, and you know, it would send her off on a rant. Yeah, but if you look at Jesus's the way that Jesus pictures how to resist evildoers without doing evil yourself, you can't do that if you're, I mean, it's not capitulation, it's resistance, but it's also not capitulation to the desire to strike back.
Well, it would be the Gandhian non-violent resistance, which is very strong. Mm-hmm. But if you take a look at Gandhi as an individual, he was a small man, and that may have played into how he became a very large voice and intellect. He wasn't going to be able to take on
strength of spirit, I think.
Yeah.
Internal strength. It's not about big muscles. No.
But there is in American history a huge thing of athletic Jesus, you know, manly man Jesus. I even hear friends on the Christian right and, you know, well, some of the Dobson books, different ones, are, you know, how to make sure your little boys, these aren't the titles, but basically the message is how to make sure your little boys grow up to be manly men.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It's big.
Oh, well, yeah, but I just, that's
it's
just not.
It's big.
Yeah, that's scary. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I think a lot of this discussion about why do good people do bad things, I think a lot of it's just about a search for security and, you know, and dealing with your fear and just being secure instead of the search for truth. What's really happening? You know, what, you know, I mean, that's, I think, what happens in this country a lot, that why people just, okay, we'll just go along with the nation, you know, it's the propaganda stuff, we have to go out and attack this country, even though Iraq never attacked us, and, you know, and we just are told this, and then, oh, well, I'm going to believe that. I'll just believe it because it makes me feel more secure to believe some person in authority is telling me the truth, instead of going, what's really happening here, then, you know, and rebelling against that or finding some way to stop what you see going on in the country, saying this is just not right.
But there are good Lutherans in my life who have said, well, thank goodness we're finally going into Iraq and doing what we should have done 10 years ago.
Mm. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, but there are, of course, there are people that feel that way. Yeah.
And I think it's important to realize that historically that way of thinking works. Mm. I mean, it works for survival of the group. You know, if you kill everyone else, then your group survives. In a very pragmatic way.
This session is technically over.
Oh, it is.
So,
yeah.
I mean,
we should do it.
Get lunch and all that good stuff.
Yeah, but I think you can say
the whole world
it doesn't work
up,
anymore.
And what does that, what good, you know, if you kill everybody else, then you destroy everything. I mean, that's, you know.
It can't work anymore.
That's right.
Yeah. It's time for us to learn to actually use our brains.
Yeah.
We need to let the group be done, and whoever
wants to keep
on, go ahead.
Yeah, so
we
thank
we'll report to
one another for our conversation that went well for a full hour.
We hope he made his connections.
Yeah, he will.
We'll let him know that great discussion
went on. We'll see you in 1 week. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah.